So there you are at work in the ED, minding your own business, wading through the hordes of chest pain patients, when you get to one that doesn't look so good. The story sounds like a PE, and while the patient's stable, there's something about the presentation that just doesn't sit right in your mind. You get the CT and the patient has a large PE. You whip out your ultrasound and find a little RV strain. Blood pressure's still fine. What's your dispo gonna be? Admit to the floor on heparin? Well, Rob sat down with Jeff Klein to discuss whether we should start thinking about using thrombolytics. Yes, thrombolytics in patients with submassive PE.
Three studies published in the past couple of years have gotten a lot of attention. Topcoat, your study. Petho, just published in New England Journal this week, actually a couple days before this interview. And Moppet.
Study one.
So starting with Petho, the one that was just published, titled Fibrinolysis for Patients with Intermediate Risk PE, about 1,000 patients were randomized to receive tenecteplase plus heparin or placebo plus heparin in normal tensive patients with intermediate risk PE. So intermediate risk meaning confirmed PE and an abnormal right ventricle on echo or CT plus a positive troponin. So the primary outcome was death or hemodynamic decompensation or collapse within 7 days after randomization. Main safety outcomes were major extracranial bleeding, ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke within 7 days of randomization. So the high points of this study, the combined endpoint in 2.6 of the tenecteplase group, 5.6 of the just heparin group reached the combined endpoint. Okay, so the combined endpoint of cardiovascular collapse or death happened in 2.6 of the tenecteplase group, 5.6 of the just heparin group. And when you look at what into that composite primary outcome, the death rate between the two groups was not statistically significant. It was the rate of hemodynamic decompensation where the real difference was. And the low point, complications were much higher in the tenecteplase group. So the conclusion of the authors was that in patients with intermediate risk PE, fibrinolytic therapy prevented hemodynamic decompensation but increased the risk of major hemorrhage and stroke. What's your take on this study?
I think that this will change no one's opinion. The people that hated lytics will continue to hate it for the reason you just said, the tenfold increase in intracranial bleed rate. And the people that liked lytics will say it prevents people from deteriorating into shock. Shock's a terrible thing to experience if you're a patient. So I think the people that are on the fence are still going to be on the fence and they're still going to wring their hands. Unfortunately, I think it's the best study we're going to get. My hat's off to Guy Millet and Stavros Konstantinidis and the whole European team for pulling off the study that needed to be done. Unfortunately, it just shows the low mortality rate with submassive PE, and we have to move more to an endpoint of quality of life. I think that when the PETHO investigators give us the 1 and 2 year follow-ups, which will include endpoints that look more like what I did in Topcoat and what they did in Moppet in terms of looking at right ventricular function and quality of life type of surveys, I think we're going to see a wider spread and a stronger signal with the long-term follow-up.
Well, let's get into that because, yeah, I think one of the criticisms of this is that maybe they were looking at the wrong outcome or too short of a duration of a particular outcome, asking the wrong question.
Before Rob and Jeff launch into the studies, let's define a couple things that always seem to confuse people. Massive PE is defined as any PE that causes hemodynamic instability. It's not about the size. It's about the effect that clot has on hemodynamics. Submassive PE also isn't about size. This is any clot that causes RV dysfunction, but the patient's hemodynamically stable. Most people, organizations, and the data agree that massive PEs should be treated with thrombolytic agents. Submassive, not so much agreement. Eventually, RV dysfunction can lead to LV dysfunction, resulting in shock and death, but this is pretty rare. Most patients will break down the clot on their own, with a little help from our friend heparin, before that happens. This is why mortality in submassive PE is so low, and it's hard to find a benefit from any treatment. There's also an issue of long-term functional outcomes. People with RV strain can go on to develop pulmonary hypertension, which really cramps your style and your ability to do things like, you know, run down the street or walk up the stairs. So what we really need to be assessing is quality of life after submassive PE. Not such an easy thing to study. The first trial these guys discuss is PETHO. And you know what I love? I love trials with great names. I imagine that at least one researcher in every study has the job of naming the trial. PETHO was the Greek god of persuasion. Now, if you ask me, this would have been a better title for a neurology study trying to convince emergency physicians that we should be giving TPA. PITHO was looking at a combined endpoint of death or hemodynamic decompensation and found a reduction. But like Rob and Jeff say, I think most of us question whether that was a good combined endpoint. The patient probably doesn't care if they have hemodynamic decompensation, or at least not nearly as much as they care if they're dead.
Dead?
Dead.
All of us.
All of you.
It'll be interesting to see what their 1 to 2 year outcomes look like in terms of quality of life. Now let's move forward through the second relevant study.
Study 2.
So that brings us to Topcoat, and that was published in the Journal of Thrombosis and Hemostasis, January 2014. Lead author, Dr. Jeffrey Klein. Topcoat meaning, or Topcoat standing for, the treatment of submassive pulmonary embolism with tenecteplase or placebo cardiopulmonary outcomes at 3 months. And since this was your study, I'll let you do the honors. So what were you looking for and what did you find?
So I'm an emergency physician, and it's somewhat curious that the pulmonologists and cardiologists did PITHO and looked for the short-term outcomes. And as an ER doctor, I went and looked for the more long-term outcomes. This was born out of work that I did back at Carolina's Medical Center with Jackie Hernandez, my centurion and program manager who I miss every day. Hi, Jackie, back in Charlotte. And we enrolled 200 patients who were normotensive. And those that deteriorated were not randomized, but those that deteriorated got lytics. And we looked at the outcomes and found that the right ventricular function of the people that got lytics was much better than the ones that did not get lytics, ones that just got heparin. And we interviewed these patients. We brought them all back at 6 months, and we did echoes, and we did 6-minute walk tests. And basically, we asked them questions about what was important to them. It was really their ability to do things that they care about, to be independent of their family members, to be able to shop, to be able to take care of themselves. So we devised an endpoint that was really measured in the short term. If you deteriorated to the point of dying, needing intubation, or needing rescue mechanical or thrombectomy, surgical thrombectomy, you met an endpoint. First 5 days, kind of like PITHO. But we didn't just require hypotension like PITHO did. Something bad had to happen, like you had to get your chest cut open to salvage you, or you had to die. Then we asked the patients to come back at 3 months, and we had, I think, 94% follow-up rate. And we re-echoed their hearts. We did a 6-minute walk test, and we asked a bunch of questions. And then we put together a composite endpoint. And this really came from what the patients told us. They wanted to be free of any burden of thrombotic consequences. And as doctors, we want a research study that tells us whether you live or die or some very important isolated endpoint. Patients actually want to know, are they going to be all clear? Am I going to be able to get back to my usual state of health? And what we found was a significant improvement in the composite endpoint of the short-term deterioration together with long-term outcomes that included right ventricular dysfunction, exercise intolerance, and the patient's perception of wellness measured with a survey called the SF-36, the standard form 36, which is a well-known thing in the literature for all kinds of disease endpoints. And if you take the composite together, patients that got lytics were more likely to be in the good than in the bad compared to people that got placebo. Bad news is we had one head bleed in the 43 patients that got tenecteplase, and we had one death from PE, directly from PE, in the placebo group. And that really shows us the equipoise between giving lytics and not giving lytics. For every patient that whose life we save, it's almost right there neck and neck that we're going to cause a bleeding problem. And the difference is more people feel better that get the lytics.
So what were your inclusion criteria? And we're talking about these, when we're talking about a massive PE, it's somebody who's hypotensive and they're in shock, but these intermediate risk PEs or these submassive PEs, different studies have different definitions of them. So who got included?
In this study, they had to have a positive biomarker or a positive echo, either one. And that could be a BNP that's elevated above 90 or 900 for pro-BNP, or any troponin that's above the 99th percentile for imprecision at the 10% coefficient of variability. So an abnormal troponin at your laboratory, and had to be normotensive, although they could have had episodic hypotension and normotensive at the time of consent. Had to have a PE proven on CT scan, or the other index of RV damage could be an echo that showed right ventricular hypokinesis.
So in this trial, the Topcoat, you used low molecular weight heparin instead of unfractionated heparin with the tenecteplase. And does it matter if we give unfractionated versus low molecular weight heparin in a patient we're going to thrombolyze? Because most of the study protocols I've seen use unfractionated heparin. And the timing is different, different recommendations, different timing. I suspect maybe because unfractionated has a short half-life, more easily reversed.
I think this comes down to the belief that with unfractionated heparin, you can stop the drip and give protamine and reverse bleeding. For all practical purposes, that doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference. The reason I use enoxaparin is more steady anticoagulation, fewer ups and downs that you get with giving a bolus and the Rashke drip of unfractionated. And overall, I think it gives patients better safety margin to give them the enoxaparin, not to mention less HIT, less heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. And they're going to go on enox anyway when they go home on warfarin, assuming that they get warfarin. So it's clear to me that they need to be on enoxaparin. And the argument that you can stop the heparin and give protamine and somehow prevent the bleeding is a non-issue. It just is.
Say you had a patient, and off the topic of the intermediate risk PE, say you had a patient with a massive PE, hemodynamic compromise, they're in shock, you're definitely going to thrombolyze them. Would you give them low molecular weight heparin as well?
The only time I wouldn't is if I thought I was going to take them to the interventional radiology. And that would be a patient that had some type of relative contraindication. And I would say that a relative contraindication right now is, I'm going to say age 70, pethos is 75. I would give unfractionated heparin to somebody that I think I'm going to take to IR because they prefer unfractionated heparin. They like to titrate it. And I'm sure not going to be the one to tell the driver how to drive his car. So if I think they're going to IR, I give them unfractionated. If I'm going to bolus slice them or I'm going to give them an infusion of alteplase, I'm going to give them low molecular weight heparin.
Quick summary on Topcoat, another wonderfully abbreviated study. Jeff took patients with submassive PE and gave them a full dose of tenecteplase plus low molecular weight heparin or placebo plus low molecular weight heparin. They defined submassive as patients with a PE who had either an echo or positive biomarkers for RV strain. The biomarkers that are traditionally used are troponin and BNP, and there are a number of studies in the literature showing that patients with elevated biomarkers in PE have worse outcomes. In fact, the biomarker studies are one of the few places in submassive PE where all the data agrees. Now, they had a number of outcomes they looked at, including the SF36 PCS score, or physical component summary score, at 90-day follow-up. This is a quality of life measure looking at how these patients were functioning. They also did TTEs looking for RV size and function. They found improved functional outcomes at 90 days. People felt better and were more able to do the things they wanted to do. Unfortunately, there was one head bleed in the tenecteplase group, but that was balanced by one death in the placebo group.
So it's interesting that the different arguments of lytics versus non-lytics, where thrombolyzing a PE may not make a difference, a significant difference in dead versus not dead, but then what's the quality of life if you don't die? And not a lot of studies have focused on that. And, you know, you did in Topcoat. And intuitively, it would seem that lytics would break down the clot, period, reperfuse, heart's going to function better. But looking at these outcomes, the outcomes that are really happening, maybe it's more complex than that.
Probably the biggest driver of quality of life is current thrombosis, either DVT or PE. And if you look at patients' quality of life surveys, they plummet when they have to go back to the emergency department and again with symptoms. I think you could almost tag it mathematically to the number of times that the patient says, I think I need to go back to the hospital for care, even if they don't get diagnosed with a clot. And that's what you see that's a big difference in my data is the ones that got lytics versus didn't. Ones that got lytics do not inhabit the emergency department with every cough and every bit of shortness of breath they have. They also have fewer recurrence rates. So that's a pretty big driver of the two. As far as the biological basis of that, I can't tell you that I know this for 100%, but it makes a lot of sense to me that if you get rid of the fibrinitis, it reduces the scarring of the endothelium where the clot sits. It reduces the inflammatory response and essentially cleans the pipes out more. I mean, where are you most likely to get a clog in your pipes? It's where you got one before. And if you leave a bunch of grease and hair in there, that's the place where it's going to clot up again. So it does more of a cleaning job that then leads to a vascular system that's less clotty, even probably out to months and years after the index event. And that's going to require more study to figure out the exact mechanisms for the reduction in recurrence rate.
Study 3.
So the third trial, MOPIT.
It's time to play the music. It's time to love.
moderate pulmonary embolism treated with thrombolysis trial got a lot of attention when it came out because the results were almost too good to be true. The author's question was, is there benefit in giving a low dose of thrombolytics to a patient with a moderate-sized pulmonary embolus? Breaking down the conclusion of Moppet, we may not keep PE patients from dying, but giving them thrombolytics may improve post-PE quality of life. And the results of Moppet were pretty striking that thrombolytics dramatically diminished the post-PE incidence of pulmonary hypertension, at least as measured by echo. And there's an interesting trial in that it used half-dose thrombolytics. And instead of using massive PE, severe hypotension, or even right heart dysfunction, or even biomarkers, Moppet used submassive PE clot burden alone as the inclusion criteria. But it was kind of a strange study. There's a lot of the methodology was not published. It was single center. There was no control group or comparison group and no functional outcome assessed. And we can infer that reducing pulmonary hypertension, at least by echo, is a good thing. But what did that mean to patients in this trial as far as their quality of life and exercise tolerance? We don't know. Maybe it can be best thought of as a dose finding trial. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it was a curious study. If you look at Topcoat and you follow my flow diagram, I'll tell you exactly how many patients I approached for informed consent. And that number was 640 for me to be able to enroll 87 patients. So you can see it is difficult to get a qualifying patient to sign a consent form to do this study. It took me everything in my life to be able to get 87 patients for Topcoat. They enrolled 120 patients. I don't quite understand the study. For instance, there's no short-term outcomes at all for the first few days in hospital. And then we end up with 120 patients, none of whom bled and none of whom had what looks like a severe PE complication.
Right, there was a zero bleeding rate.
Such as death. So it's unusual in that regard. Yeah, it has some questions about it. And their endpoint was purely echo, purely ultrasound of the heart, not asking the patient questions, functional outcomes, six-minute walk test. There's really nothing that touches the patient other than the echocardiography probe in the outcomes of that study. And again, including stuff in hospital that was not reported. Now, the authors may know it, but it wasn't reported in that paper. And I personally do not know these authors. Interestingly, I've been reviewing meta-analyses that now are coming out that are like, what happens if people do these meta-analyses? You know, they come to authors of randomized trials and try to get their data as soon as they can to cram them into a systematic review meta-analysis and get it out as soon as they can. Two of them came to me. One of them hit a journal and I reviewed it. And they actually did not even include Moppet in the meta-analysis. And I think the reason is because Moppet doesn't have any short-term outcomes. So Moppet's a bit of a weird study, and it provokes our thought that maybe giving a lower dose of lytic could benefit some patients. You have a very clinically oriented audience, but I want to tell the audience something that they need to hear about lytic dose. The fact that we use one dose fits all lytics for all patients with PE is absolutely ridiculous. And the primary driver is going to be multifactorial in terms of how the patient is made, in terms of their resistance to the actual alteplase and the resulting plasmin that is formed. There's extreme heterogeneity. And even though I hate the term personalized medicine, because I don't think there is such a thing in emergency medicine, this is a case where we are going to get some biomarkers to let physicians know some patients need twice as much alteplase as we give them, and some of them need one-tenth the dose. It just depends on the inhibitors that they carry in their body that blocks the effect of the alteplase. And this is an area of research that I'm working on in our laboratory, including Bo Stubblefield, will be publishing in very soon. So I try to predict the future for your audience to know you will one day have a biomarker that helps direct your dose of fibrinolytics for PE. It's not going to happen in the next couple of years, but it will happen. If you're under age 50, you'll be doing it.
Well, there's definitely movement for using the half-dose thrombolytics based on Moppet. I know that's gotten a lot of discussion in the emergency medicine community saying, hey, half-dose lytics, I mean, all the blood goes into the pulmonary tree. Makes sense. Let's do it.
Yeah, it's more complicated than that, though, because in some patients, you could give them full-dose lytic, and it's all going to be inactivated by the time it gets to the lung. It just depends on unique proteomics of individual people. And we need to be able to figure out a simple, rapid test that tells us what the dose should be. And it's probably going to be less dependent on clot burden than you would think.
Final study Rob and Jeff discuss is the Moppet trial.
It's the Moppet show.
No, not Muppet.
Wait a minute.
But Moppet, or moderate PE treated with thrombolysis trial. This was actually the first one that was published of the three back in 2013. Now, they took patients with submassive PE, although they defined this a little differently, and gave them a half dose of alteplase plus anticoagulation versus anticoagulation alone. The trial wasn't blinded, which is always an issue, and their outcome was basically pulmonary hypertension on echo at 28 months. That's nice long-term outcome, but not as straightforward of an outcome because it's not a pure patient-centered one. When I think about submassive PE and I look at these three studies, I get almost no clarity on what I should do for the patient in front of me. The data here actually muddies the water, making it more difficult to figure out the best management. That's why this next section is so great. Rob peppers Jeff with some cases to see what the master of thromboembolism would do and how he would have the discussion with the patient.
All right, you ready to break out the nunchucks?
Yeah, what are we doing?
So I want to go through some cases because this is really where the rubber meets the road, because like the indications for thrombolyzing acute PE seem to be a moving target. So I want to run through a few scenarios with two primary questions for each. And this is based on your take on the literature and your practice. The questions are, would you give thrombolytics and what is the benefit?
Case one.
So patient number one, status post total hip, 60 years old, big fat swollen red leg, acute chest pain, syncope, arrest, screams PE, it's PE, CPR is in progress when the medics arrive. The chance of you getting this patient to CT to confirm the diagnosis of PE is zero. So you've got a very high pretest probability. You're never going to get the post-test probably because he's not going to make it to CT. Would you give lytics?
What was the age again?
60.
You're going to pick a bunch of cases that are right at equipoise. Do I get a bedside echo that shows a dilated RV?
Well, you're doing CPR, so it's going to be hard to do your echo.
Yeah, but you can still look at it. I mean, it'll be huge.
Okay, sure. You have a bedside echo, it's just a dilated RV.
It's a dilated RV. Yeah. I would bolus the alteplase, just bolus it. There's no reason to infuse it. You know, we got to get the drug to the fibrin and begin converting plasminogen. And, you know, it can melt enough clot that you can save a life. I got to tell you personally, I've never had success doing this. And I don't want to tell you how many times I've done it. One of the reasons I don't want to tell you how many times I've done it is I don't want to think about the cost. Because, you know, when I started doing Topcoat in 2008, this is 2008, the acquisition cost of my hospital for tenecteplase and alteplase was the same. It was around $5,500. It is now $20,000.
Man.
That's acquisition cost. That's what my pharmacy pays Genentech to get the drug in the pharmacy. That's not what the patient pays. So that's a pretty big, you know, you're injecting a, I don't know, Mercedes-Benz in terms of the patient's bill. Of course, the patient's probably not going to care.
Is there any evidence that somebody who's arresting that has a PE and gets lytics, is there evidence of a mortality benefit?
The survival rate that's been reported in case reports, and actually Paul Stein from PioPed fame put together what you could call a systematic review of all the case reports and found an astounding 60% survival rate in all the case reports. Obviously, they're biased in favor of those that survive.
Cardiac arrest with highly suspected or confirmed PE? Jeff recommends giving the lytics with the caveat that these patients tend not to do so well, so you may just be pissing in the wind.
Don't do it, don't do it.
Jeff gives a small plug here for ultrasound and cardiac arrest, a point that can't be stressed enough. Ultrasound can really help you make the diagnosis and guide your resuscitation and management. Now, I'm sure that Zach and Joe from the ED ECMO podcast are going to chime in and let us know that patients like this may be perfect candidates for ECMO, but we'll go ahead and save that discussion for another time.
Case two.
Okay, so the next patient is, let's say they're 50 years old, got a massive PE seen on CT. They are hypotensive, systolic pressure is 80, and severe right heart dysfunction. In this case, we'll say the RV is dilated on CT, you get an echo, RV is dilated. Patient's still talking to you, and would you give them lytics?
If there's not a contraindication, that's a no-brainer, yes.
And what would you say to them? That patient's talking to you, say, I've got this medication I'm going to give you that could potentially dissolve the clots. And you know, what's the benefit? What's the risk?
I would tell them that the chance of you deteriorating to the point where we will have to put you on life support, meaning infusing chemicals into your body for your heart and blood vessels to be able to sustain blood flow to your brain. And we probably will have to put you on a breathing machine. The chance of you getting to that point without this drug is about 50%. Your chance of dying is probably 20 to 25%. I think that we can cut those chances in half by giving you this drug. However, your chance of having bleeding, severe bleeding, even bleeding in your brain, is going to go up probably 4 or 5 fold getting this drug. It's going to be somewhere around, what was the age you gave me?
50.
50. Your chance of bleeding in your brain is going to be somewhere around 1 in 50. So that's what I would say to the patient. And my number that I'm going to give them is inversely proportional to their age, pure and simple. And it goes up exponentially after age 60. So I'm going to give them like about a 1 in 40 or 1 in 50. If they're age 60, I'm going to tell them 1 in 40. If they're age 70, I'm going to tell them 1 in 20. And if they're over that, I'm going to tell them, you got to tell me to give you this drug, because your chance of bleeding in the brain, I'm going to tell them, is 1 in 10.
Now, case number 2 that they discuss is a patient with a massive PE. Patient's awake but markedly hypotensive. These patients decompensate and die frequently. This is a patient you should probably give lytics to, and you can frame the discussion the way Jeff lays out. There's good data that says this drug will decrease your mortality, but there's also a risk of increased bleeding. Just to help your decision here, the American College of Chest Physicians, the AHA, and ASEP all endorse giving systemic thrombolytics to patients with massive PE.
Case 3.
26-year-old woman on birth control, just had a knee scope, pleuritic chest pain, vitals are normal, big clot burden on CT. You get an echo, stone cold normal, BNP and troponin are normal. So let's say it's a saddle embolus. It's a big clot, but all of the other stuff, the accoutrement of the PE, are normal. Would you give her lytics?
No, I would not. The proximal location of the clot has predictive value that is significant. I think it's actually more valuable than the RV to LV ratio, and that is being shown by the work by David Jimenez. It's coming out in AJRCCM very soon. It's the largest series, 1,500 patients with pulmonary embolism. And what he found is, out of the indexes on CT scan, proximal location of clot is probably the most powerful of the predictors that we have on CT scan, including RV-LV ratio, percentage obstruction. So that in and of itself, in this young lady with normal biomarkers and a normal echo, is categorically a predictor of deterioration. But everything you're telling me, she's going to do very well on heparin. And yeah, I'd just give her heparin. I wouldn't risk the lytics in this case.
Okay. Well, let's say that all that stuff was normal and there's big clot burden regardless of where it is, because it doesn't sound like that's going to drive you. And there's a troponin bump.
Yeah, then she gets lytics.
And she gets lytics. Okay.
Yeah, because her risk of death then goes from 2% to 20% with a troponin bump. I mean, it's a huge increase.
And are you going to group troponin, BNP, and signs of right heart dysfunction all as the same thing if there's something else positive that's going to increase mortality?
They all have a profound increase in the chance of deterioration to death. Troponin happens to be the most specific and have the highest likelihood ratio positive. The overall best screening tool, I still think, is the brain natriuretic peptide to decide whether or not you need advanced therapy, though. Echo is helpful, but it depends on what the reader gives you. Is severe hypokinesis the same as mild hypokinesis? Echo is qualitative, and it's almost an opinion of the cardiologist as opposed to any single measurement. But a new troponin bump in a young person means she's really damaging RV, and it's going to get worse if it bumps that early. A lot of the troponin comes from inflammation, and the inflammation starts to hit somewhere around 6 hours after stretch. So she's got worsening RV function ahead of her, and I want to unload that ventricle. So that's different patient than the one that doesn't have an elevated trope.
Okay, case number 3 is a patient with a big clot on CT scan, but no hemodynamic compromise, no RV strain, and no positive biomarkers. Jeff says no lytics. These patients have been shown not to benefit from lytics, but they can still bleed. But what if we add to that case a positive biomarker, so a positive troponin? We should now consider lytics, not because there's a mortality benefit, but because there's a potential benefit in functional outcomes for quality of life. For my money, this benefit is more relevant in younger patients who also seem to be less likely to bleed.
All right, Jeff. Well, I think we are out of time for today. Thanks so much for joining us again, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Rob.
And if you are Twitter followers, Jeff Klein is now on Twitter. Jeff Klein has entered the space age. Jeff, what's your handle?
It's @KleinLab, all one word, KLINELAB.
Yes, and I follow Klein Lab. It's just a world of delightful information regarding thrombosis, hemostasis, and pulmonary emboli.